Hello, everybody. My name is Nate. I'm glad that you are here. Good to see you. Hey, before we jump into this, just a little extra information on times. So do not come to church next Sunday at 11:15 because it's going to be quiet. Actually, it's going to be filled with people like who are rehearsing, and they'll probably draw you in. You'll have to play like harmonica or something. So you don't want to do that. Here's what we're going to do. In order to make room for lots and lots of people, we usually have thousands and thousands of guests. We're going to have 7 Christmas Eve services. They're all the same, but they won't be on our typical Saturday night and then 2 on Sunday morning. We're shifting everything, adding 4 services. So they will begin at these times, the 22nd, which is next Sunday, at 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. Okay, and then the 23rd, which is Monday, 5:30, 7:30, and then the 24th, which is actually Christmas Eve, 1, 3, and 5. So we do that so that people, if you've got like, we got to go visit Grandma and Helena, you can come on the 22nd. People who are working retail, we try to have services at different times and on the weekend. So hopefully there's room and opportunity for everybody to be a part of that. Sound good? So don't come to church next Sunday morning. Seriously, it won't be good. We started this series last week looking at Matthew, the book of Matthew. Matthew is one of the individuals who writes a biography of the life of Jesus. And we look at how he began his biography, and it's like not compelling, it's tedious, it's cumbersome. He introduces Jesus through this genealogy, who Jesus' ancestors were. And what we see is that it's absolutely atypical. This is not how you would introduce a king's genealogy. He introduces 5 women. That's unheard of. He mentions all the scandals that happened in Jesus' family of origin. He just wants everybody to know that Jesus came for everybody. Now, Jesus wasn't afraid of human brokenness, that he entered into the story. And now what I'd like to do is I'd like us to look at verse 18 from Matthew chapter 1 on. And we look at Joseph, who aside from Matthew, gets very little in terms of mention. In fact, we have this from Matthew, but we don't hear anything about Joseph later in Jesus' life. He most likely died at a younger age. He wasn't there when Jesus was crucified. What do we know about him? He's kind of the one member of the story that doesn't get talked about. People are going to be talking about Mary all over the planet today, but not Joseph. Some really, really interesting things I think we can learn from him. I was deeply inspired as I spent a bit of time studying him. Now, before we read from Matthew chapter 1, I want us just to kind of enter into the first century world for a moment, okay? And enter into Joseph's life in particular, because I think if we can enter into his life, we'll understand how significant some of his decisions are. So in today's world, if there are 2 people and they were in my family, I ask my kids, are you fond of her, right? Or fond of him? They're like, that's the lamest word. I'm like, but I like it. I like it personally. And so what happens? Like a couple people notice each other and bat your eyes, and then you spend some time getting to know each other. And then if everything went well, like you spend some time in what we call dating, which in the first century did not exist. By the way, dating seems to have been introduced about 80 years ago to human culture. Anybody think dating's weird? Well, it is. It's new, okay? So these people kind of get to know each other a little bit in today's world, and then the big step is like, we're going to get engaged. And then you have this period of time where you're getting ready and you design websites and register at Target, okay? And then you're ready for your wedding. It's a big day. Think of how differently it would have been 2,000 years ago in a first century Jewish village. Nazareth, we believe, was somewhere between 200 and 300 people. Okay, it is a tiny little village. I'm from like rural areas. Anybody from a town of 200? Anybody? All right, here's what, when you're from a town of 200, everybody knows everything about everybody, don't they? Like your neighbors go, hey, I saw you had a package delivered. You're like, yeah, right? And the other thing is you're related to just about everybody. Like, oh, I liked her. She's my cousin, can't marry her. Okay, I'll keep looking, right? Like you're just related to everybody. It's small town. Well, you took that back 2,000 years ago. You're in a small town. Here's where Joseph grows up. And this is how two people ended up married in that culture. Is the young man, Joseph, would have reached an age probably around 16 or 17. And dad would have said, Joseph, it's time for you to become a man. I'm going to find you a wife. And that was just normal. Like Joseph didn't go, come on, dad, I want to find a wife. Nope. There just was no question. It was always arranged marriages. And so Joseph's dad starts watching the village girls. Finally, he goes, like her? What's her name? Mary. Okay. So Joseph's dad is ready. He approaches Mary's father. They sit down at a table. They pour a glass of wine. Okay, but nobody touches it. It's one glass of wine. They sit down. Joseph's dad says, all right, sir, I would like for our families to come together. I want my son to marry your daughter. And Mary's dad would go, oh, okay, that sounds good. My daughter is an exceptional woman. So exceptional. She's worth 10 shekels, 12 goats, and 7 sheep. And Joseph's dad goes, you've got to be kidding me. She's not worth half that. Who do you think she is? So they barter back and forth, back and forth until they come up with the dowry or the bride price. And then when they decide, okay, our families are gonna be united. This is the price that's involved. They shake hands, they drink from the mutual cup, and the couple is now betrothed. They may have never met each other, okay? They're betrothed. Betrothal, it's a form of engagement, would last about a year. Here's what had to happen in that 1 year. Joseph, dad came home, said, I found the right girl for you. Her name is Mary. Here's what Joseph had to do. He had two big responsibilities in that year. Number one, he had to save enough money to have a wedding celebration. And in first century Jewish culture, the wedding lasts 6 days. And you are responsible to feed and provide wine for everybody. And when you live in a village of 200, who do you invite to your wedding? Everybody, right? So he's like, okay. And here's the second responsibility. He has to build a house for his wife. So every groom had to do this. But you didn't like pick a, you know, oh, let's live up on that mountaintop in that field. Came to your dad's house. Your dad's house, if you look at any first century architecture, is house connected, really room connected to room connected to room. And his dad and his granddad and his great grandpa had all been in the same complex. And so you came to dad's house and you walked around the outside and you said, Dad, what about this wall? Dad said, okay. And you cut a door and then you built an additional room onto your father's house. You had 1 year to complete this. And when that was completed, it was time for you to get married. So everything is going along as normal. Joseph, Mary, they're anticipating this new life. Mary's gonna come and join Joseph's family in a patriarchal society. And they're excited. They're just a young couple, a couple of teenagers in love, anticipating becoming adults and having a family, all these beautiful things. And then Joseph hears a little whispering around his little village, Nazareth. Have you guys seen Mary? Yeah. And then Mary disappears. She disappears. She goes to meet her cousin Elizabeth. And there's been these rumors circulating. Remember, this is a rigid, rigid, conservative, religious culture. There's these rumors that Joseph's heard. He doesn't get to talk to Mary. That's not part of the engagement. I think Mary's pregnant. Who does everybody look at in town? Joseph, right? Mary comes back from her cousins. She's pregnant. Whew. Listen, in this world, this is catastrophic. It would have been catastrophic. It would have been scandalous. It's a little village of a couple hundred people. Joseph has all these questions. Can you imagine the level of betrayal he feels? It's like, I thought we had a future together. Like, what in the world happened? And now, who's everybody suspecting? Joseph. Just, no, seriously, I wasn't involved. It wasn't me. This is where we're going to pick up the story. Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus the Messiah came about. His mother Mary was pledged to be married to Joseph. But before they came together, meaning they had no sexual union, she was found to be pregnant through the Holy Spirit. Now, for those of us in the room, and we are spiritually unresolved, we're trying to figure out what we believe, this is going to be one of those big things that you have to work through, okay? Because you went to sex ed class in seventh grade, and this is not what they taught you, right? It was like, what? So here's part of what the whole message of Christmas hangs on. It's predicated on this thought. Jesus was the God-man. The story of Christmas is that God enters the human race to experience everything we experience, to live the life we couldn't live, to die in our place. So this is the radical, mind-blowing part of Christmas, is that Jesus' father is not Joseph. Now, how does this work? I can't tell you. It's called the incarnation. Is that God says, I'm going to send my son. I will be the father of this child. Mary will be his mother. He will be God and man. Because Joseph, her husband, now they're just betrothed, but you're called somebody's spouse during that time, was faithful to the law. Meaning this is like, he's an upright guy. He's a man of integrity. He's trying to live life right. And yet, did not want to expose her to public disgrace. He had in mind to divorce her quietly. But after he considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Joshua, Jesus, Yeshua in Hebrew, which means God saves, because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet, going back hundreds of years. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. God with us. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him and took Mary home as his wife. But he did not consummate their marriage until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus, Yeshua. There's more to the story that we won't be able to read. Eventually, Joseph's life is going to be threatened by King Herod, and he's going to have to flee with Mary and baby Jesus. He's going to live as a refugee for at least 2, maybe 4 years in Egypt, live as a foreigner in a foreign country. Life is going to be tumultuous. For the rest of his life, there's going to be a stigma. The baby Jesus was born as an illegitimate child. Joseph was the dad. Mary was the mother. It's not an easy thing. God gives him a clear assignment. He says, I want you to take Mary to be your wife. I want you to name this baby Jesus. I want you to raise him as your son. Here's some things that I think we can learn from Joseph's life. Number one, being part of what God is doing often means difficult choices. If I want to be a part of the big story that God is accomplishing on planet Earth, it's going to mean that I will face difficult choices. I'm going to have to make some decisions about how I will respond, who I'm going to be. Let's go through some of these choices. Number one, is Joseph going to, is he going to abide by the law, or is he going to choose love? Because here's what the law says. He had three choices with Mary legally. Okay, three choices. Number one, he could take her as his wife. That was kind of probably his last-ditch effort. Like, because what does everybody think? All right, yeah, you're really the dad. Secondly, choice was this. The Old Testament says that there's actually a death sentence for this. He could have pushed, could have shamed her. Third choice is he can divorce her quietly so she's not publicly shamed. You had to actually, during the betrothal period, you had to sign a document that says you're divorced. It could have just said, Mary, this isn't my responsibility. Mary, I don't know what happened here. I feel so betrayed. I feel alone. You're just going to have to figure this out by yourself. Those are his three choices. He could have said, this isn't fair. I didn't ask for this. I'm just growing up in my little town. I didn't ask to be entered into some big plan of God and have a dream and an angel tells me Mary's really right. You're going to live according to the law or are you going to live according to love? Is it all about what's right and fair and just? Because God's going to ask us to do things that aren't always right and fair and just, but are loving. Reputation versus obedience. He's a devout man. Anybody, if you grew up in a small town, if you lose your reputation and you're a tradesman, what happens? So Jesus, the Greek word is technon, means he was a worker with his hands. He was a tradesman. Early when people in Europe were translating the Bible, they assumed that meant a carpenter because in Europe, they make everything out of wood. Well, you go to Israel, you go to the Middle East, there's very little wood. You go to any first century homes, everything's made out of stone. So Jesus is probably a stonemason, right? He builds things with his hands. He's a tradesman. You live in a city of 200 people and your reputation is soiled. What happens to your future in that town? You don't have a chance. So Joseph has to decide, am I going to defend my reputation or am I going to obey? What's it going to be? Is it going to be my agenda? Because here's his agenda. I'm just going to keep doing what my ancestors have always done. They're good people. They're respected in this little community. I'm going to build my little house next to my dad's house. One day, this whole thing will be mine. I'm going to keep moving ahead. I'm just going to marry a nice little girl from my village. We'll have our own family. That's his agenda. But God introduces a radically different, disruptive agenda. Will he stay with the known? Or will he move towards the unknown? Will he look to convenience? What can I do? What's the easiest thing for me? Or will he move towards discomfort? This list, these choices are what we face every day. Am I going to be a part of the story of what God is doing on planet Earth? I'll tell you what, there is something in every one of us that craves this because this is comfortable, this is predictable, and this is fair. This is fair. This is what I wanted. This is what I expected. And God is going to ask us to make decisions that slide over into this category. That's sometimes terrifying and it's unknown and it's not always fair and it's sacrificial and it's not easy. If I want to be a part of what God is doing on this planet, I'm going to have to make difficult choices. Number two, pleasing God often means disappointing people. If you're in a small village of 200 people, and your first defense is this, Mom, Dad, seriously, it wasn't me. I am not the father of that baby. They're going to defend you. Your whole clan's going to defend you. Then an angel comes at night and says, hey, I want you to go ahead and take her as your wife. I want you to raise this baby. I want you to call him Jesus. Don't name him after you or your family members. Here's your new assignment. Then you've already defended yourself. You said, no, I'm not the father. Then you wake up the next day and you say, everybody, I'm taking her as my wife. They're going to say, why would you do that? What are you going to do? You know his parents are disappointed. For Mary, how did Mary's mom and dad look at her when she said, hey guys, I'm pregnant, but is God? How would you look at a teenage girl who said, I'm carrying a baby, but God's the one who got me pregnant? You look at her and go like, come on. What's going on? Everybody's disappointed in this teenage couple. If I want to obey God, sometimes I'm going to have to disappoint people. Couple of phrases. Becoming obsessed with what people think about you is the quickest way to forget what God thinks about you. If I am obsessed with people's thoughts. How am I perceived? Am I valued? Do people look at me admiringly? If I'm obsessed with that, I will quickly forget what God thinks about me. This will take over. I had a marvelous experience on Wednesday night. I got to go to our middle school group, 200 plus kids, and I just thought, God, somehow I survived this age group. Thank you. And it was just interesting because when you're in middle school, you're just looking around like, do I fit in? Do people love me? It's obsession, right, with what people think about you. Here's the inverse of this. Let's turn this around. Becoming obsessed with what God thinks about you is the quickest way to forget what people think about you. Here's what Joseph had to do. I am choosing to live for God in this moment, not for my family, not for my clan. I'm choosing to care more about what God thinks about me than what everybody thinks of me when I walk through town and they look at me like, mm-hmm. Well, you know what would have been really convenient? If the angel would have showed up and told everybody else in Nazareth. Wouldn't that be nice? Hey, 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 you guys, don't look down on Joseph. It wasn't him. This is actually God's baby. Mary's telling the truth. Joseph's telling the truth. The angel doesn't tell anyone except for Mary and Joseph. Number three, extraordinary acts of God often start with ordinary acts of human obedience. These extraordinary, unique acts of God, they are often predicated upon. They're often set into motion by a human being choosing to do an ordinary, simple act of obedience. The beginning of Matthew chapter 1, we read that God has been working in human history through all of these generations. This point of culmination where Jesus would come into the world, where God would send his son into the human gene pool, right? And the whole thing is dependent on two teenagers cooperating with him and saying yes. I love teenagers. I've raised four of them. I would not personally dictate the future of the world on whether teenagers are gonna do the right thing, right? Do the sacrificial thing, the obedient thing. God says, here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna make this whole plan is gonna be dependent on Mary and Joseph saying, okay, God, if you say so, I'm interruptible. I'll do it. So God does extraordinary acts of obedience. Start with ordinary acts of human extraordinary acts of God. Start with ordinary acts of human obedience. Now, here's something I've learned about obedience. This has been so helpful to me. You don't have to understand completely to obey immediately. So often in life, we have this sense we're supposed to do something. I'm supposed to follow God in this unique thing. I'm supposed to pick up some cause. I'm supposed to care for a person that I'm not obligated to. Now here's what I want to know. God, could you answer all my questions first? God, can you explain what will happen if I do obey? Will I be safe? Will you provide? Do you think Mary at any point said, so, okay, I'm going to be pregnant. It's God's baby. I bet she had a million questions. Will Joseph reject me? Will my family reject me? Will I have to raise this child as a single mom? How will I provide? How will I feed for this child? There's a million questions. Joseph has a million questions. Will I even be allowed to live in this town anymore? Will people look down on me for the rest of my life? He's got all these questions. But God doesn't answer all his questions. That is why we call it faith. I do not have to understand completely. And if I wait around and say, God, will you answer all my questions? Will you give me surety? Will you make sure everything's okay? Then it's no longer faith. Here's a young man named Joseph who says, I've never heard of anything like this. I have no idea what's gonna happen if I do this. But I'm obeying. God doesn't always give the details that you and I would like. Some of us were waiting around to get more assurances. We're afraid of the risk. You don't have to understand completely to obey immediately. Number four, the path of least resistance is often drastically different than the path of discipleship. Okay, the path of least resistance is often drastically different than the path of discipleship. Now, for some of us in the room, this is a very interesting foreign word. Let me take a moment and describe what discipleship is. Discipleship was a first century way of training or teaching the next generation. So in particular, teachers of the law, of the scriptures, they're called rabbis, teachers, and they would invest in the future by bringing a disciple, somebody they saw great potential in, and they would say, follow me. And then you would follow this rabbi, and you spend years with the rabbi, submitted to their teaching, being taught, educated, shaped by this teacher. Okay, so this is called discipleship. It'd be the same if you're going to learn to be a tradesman or to make shoes. You'd be a disciple of someone who was in that profession, and you're transformed into that eventually. Jesus, when he walked the planet, he didn't just ask people if they believed he existed. He didn't look at people and say, hey, do you believe that I am really here? They looked at him and go, uh-huh. This is what he asked of them. Would you follow me? Would you become my disciple? Would you give up your security? Would you pursue me? Would you put yourself in the position of learner and allow me to be your teacher? So Jesus is calling disciples. So the path of discipleship is often radically different than the path of least resistance. And Jesus says competing things. There's a tension here. One occasion where people feel religiously oppressed and overwhelmed, Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy laden. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. I'm gonna give you rest. So the picture is an oxen who's carrying a burden that's too heavy. He says, no, you come to me because my religious expectations for you are not there. I'll give you rest. So he says that. But on the other hand, he says to his disciples, unless you pick up your cross daily and follow me, you can't be my disciple. Unless you pick up the form of Roman execution, the most violent ever conceived, and follow me daily, you can't be my disciple. So there's this discipleship is, there's this beautiful weight that's lifted. I don't save myself, Jesus saves me. But there's also this, Jesus says, this isn't an easy path. It's not easy whatsoever. Will I embrace the challenges? I want to speak for just a moment to the men in the room. Women, this applies to you as well, but I think most of us are always a little bit concerned about the state of masculinity. Okay? Here's what we can learn from Joseph. He does not take the path of least resistance. What is the easiest thing for this guy to do? It's to take off. Listen, I had nothing to do with this. This woman's crazy. He can defend himself. He doesn't do that. Men, life is not about self-gratification. It is not about finding the easiest way, taking the safest route. It's not about convenience. We never write biographies about people who like, oh, he was exceptional. He played golf and fly fished. And he had so much fun doing it. We write books, we tell stories, we make movies about people who sacrifice, who take on something that wasn't their responsibility. And here's what Joseph shows us. Instead of the path of least resistance, God says, I've got an assignment for you, Joseph, and it's not something you asked for. You're just a teenager, but I'm gonna call on you to step up. I have two people that I want you to embrace and carry on your shoulders. I've got Mary, who you feel utterly betrayed by right now. I want you to take her and love her as your wife. And I want you to take that baby that is not yours. And I want you to carry him till he grows up. Do you think at any point Joseph as a teenage boy was ever like, dear God, would you please allow me to be the son, the father of God? Like, I'd love to raise God. This is not what you ask for. But Joseph says, all right, God, here's what I think is so important in manhood. Pick up the most significant people and the most significant causes and carry them. Put the weight on your shoulders and start to move forward. Don't look for life to be fair. Don't look for life to be easy. That is not the point of life, nor is it the point of discipleship. Point number five, facing fear. Facing fear. Jesus, the angel says this, Joseph, I don't want you to be afraid to take Mary as your wife. It is usually fear. Keeps us from doing the bold thing. Fear of what people will say. Fear of the unknown. Fear dominates our decisions. The angel says, listen, Joseph, if you let fear dominate this decision, if you're afraid, you will not be able to do the right thing. Our fears will intimidate us. Our fears will cry to us to take the easiest possible route. This is from God. Fear's a big thing. It keeps us paralyzed. I'll show you a picture. I was thinking about the path of discipleship. I was thinking about fear. You probably see it really clearly on that big screen. So imagine this is the path of following God. Here's the challenge with it. I can only see so far. Right? I'm on this journey. Joseph is right here. All he hears is this. I want you to go take Mary as your wife and raise Jesus as your son. But what about? What's on the other side? What's going to happen in Egypt? What will people say about me for the rest of my life? God says, I'm not going to tell you about that. Here's what I want. I want you to not be afraid that what's on the other side, I'll take care of. I'll be there. And it's our limited perspective that paralyzes us with fear. If I obey God, what will happen? God won't tell you. You have to trust. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to make the right decision. Do not be afraid to love someone that you are not responsible for. Do not be afraid to take up a cause that breaks your heart and is overwhelming. Do not be afraid to look at your financial life and say, you know what? I'm going to do this differently. I'm gonna take some courageous moves and I'm gonna look at, do not be afraid to look at your business and your industry and say, I'm gonna do this the way God tells me to do it. And I don't know what's gonna happen and there are no guarantees, but I am not gonna let fear dictate my actions. Do not be afraid. Will you pray with me? Father, there's a teenage young man who lives in a little village. And life is predictable, and life seems easy until you interrupt it. I think that's the same thing that happens in our lives. We're on a path and you encounter us. And you call us to something higher, into something better, and something frightening. You call us to love people instead of worrying about what's just and fair. You call us to surrender our personal agenda for your agenda. You call us away from convenience and comfort into a life of sacrificial discomfort. Lord, would we learn from Joseph? Would we be a part of the big thing that you are doing here on planet Earth? In our culture that craves convenience and ease and comfort. Help us to look beyond that, to choose obedience and surrender so that we can be a part of something big and genuine and transformational. If you keep your eyes closed for one moment, I just want to make an invitation. For anyone who's in the room, I'm not asking if you believe Jesus existed. My question is bigger than that. I'm asking, are you ready? Is this your time to surrender your life to Jesus? Do you need a Savior? Do you realize someone has to forgive me for my sins? I cannot keep up. I am not a good enough person. The answer is this, is that Jesus came and lived the life you couldn't live and died in your place. Are you ready to become his disciple, that you follow him? You realize God does not exist for your benefit. You exist for God's benefit. If you're ready to make that decision, would you just boldly raise your hand and wave at me? I want to make eye contact with you. Yes, and yes. Yes, yes, sir. Yes, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, yes, ma'am, you're his. There, yes, ma'am. Yeah, I see you right back there and there as well. Beautiful, beautiful, here. Sorry I missed you early. Yes, ma'am. I see you. Here. Yeah. Here he is. Here. I see your son. Yeah, right in the back. Yes, sir. Yeah. Anybody, if you're in the balcony. Oh, I'm sorry I missed you. Okay. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir, right there. If you're in the balcony, there and there. Yeah, and there. Beautiful. Anybody else up there? Yeah, I see your hand. Yes, 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 yes. Okay, and over here as well. Yeah, it's beautiful. Wow. Hey, everybody, would you applaud for a whole bunch of people that made an incredibly courageous decision. Wow. Hey, if you did raise your hand, would you just take the next step? Stop by one of these I Have Decided booths. We want to get a Bible in your hands to help you start on this journey. Everybody else, be brave, be courageous. Be the hands, the feet, and mouthpiece of Jesus. If you need prayer, there's people up front you can trust. God bless you. See you for Christmas Eve services next week.